Hi, I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. This week's theme is youth. We'll have a report on how migrant children separated from their families at the U.S. border are being housed and fed.
Right now, what we're very worried about is just the influx of kids created by this zero tolerance policy.
We'll also look into a program that's ensuring free summer meals for kids are only a text message away.
Summer is the hungriest time of year for a kid who may not have that safety net of school meals.
We discover a new home economics curriculum.
I'm not trying to raise a generation of chefs. I'm trying to raise a generation of nourishers who can nourish themselves.
And we meet a teen chef who's talked his way into several of New York's top kitchens.
I never try and be, like, annoying about it, but I really want to get my foot in the door.
Tune in to this week's episode of Meat and Three, available at heritageradionetwork.org and wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, Bomb Squad. I'm your host, Carrie Diamond, and you're listening to Radio Cherry Bomb. Each week, we bring you the best conversations with women in and around the world of food. We have a great interview for you today, and it's all about raising money. But first, let's thank our sponsors. Be sure to support them because they keep Radio Cherry Bomb on the air. If you are daydreaming about culinary school, maybe it's time to say bonjour to Le Cordon Bleu. Learn more about the legendary culinary school's most prestigious professional qualification, Le Grand Diplôme, by visiting cordonbleu.edu. Bob's Red Mill is an employee-owned company that has been offering organic, gluten-free, and stone-ground products for decades. With Bob's Red Mill, you're not just getting quality, you're getting flavor-packed ingredients that taste amazing. Visit bobsredmill.com today. Some Cherry Bomb housekeeping. We're about to start shipping our new issue with cover girl Nigella Lawson. You can order a copy at cherrybomb.com. We're offering free shipping all month long and 25% off all Bomb Squad merch, like our chef shirts, enamel pins, and our collaboration sweatshirt with Claire V, and our collab apron with Headley and Bennett. Also, the finale of our Future of Food tour is taking place July 29th in Austin, Texas, at the Line Hotel. We'll have snacks and drinks, lots of networking, and a panel discussion with some of our friends on the Austin food scene, like Kristen Kish. We'll record it all for a future episode of Radio Cherry Bomb. You probably know this, but Kristen opened a restaurant at the Line Hotel called Arlo Gray, and I'll definitely be eating there while I'm in town. If you have any suggestions of other places to eat in Austin, feel free to DM us on Instagram. Tickets are on sale right now via cherrybomb.com. Thank you to Kerrygold and Mossy Agricola Wines for supporting our tour. Today's show is all about the money, honey. Our guest is Jen Pelka, the founder and CEO of Magnum PR, a full-service communications and marketing agency based in San Francisco. They work with food, wine, and hospitality brands. Jen's had a great career that has included stints at OpenTable, Gilt, Tumblr, and Restaurant Danielle. Last year, she opened The Riddler, a beautiful intimate champagne bar in San Francisco's Hayes Valley. She needed to raise $650,000, so she came up with a very interesting investment strategy: organize an all-woman investment group. Jen wound up raising money from 33 women, some of whom were new to restaurant investing. But it wasn't easy. As she'll soon tell us, Jen was hustling until the doors of The Riddler opened. Hear how she did it and what advice she has for those of you looking for money for your projects. Jen was in town for our Jubilee conference this spring, and we recorded this interview the day after. The whole reason we had asked Jen to come on the show was because we had an interesting conversation with her at a dinner in San Francisco that OpenTable hosted called Open Conversations. It all stemmed from the Me Too conversation that was taking place, and a lot of the conversation wound up being about money and finances and investing. So thank you to the OpenTable people for getting that conversation started. And I really hope you enjoy my conversation with Jen. Jen Pelka, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thank you so much for having me.
How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much. How are you?
I'm pretty good. You know, these are the post-Jubilee interviews, so yes. a little exhausted, but so many incredible women are in town just for Jubilee that I didn't want to miss the opportunity to interview them, and you are one of those people.
Oh, thank you so much.
And before we jump into the real reason why you're here and what we're going to talk about, you were on vacation in Mexico, and it sounded so amazing. I want you to tell us a little bit more and tell us where you went, because I think a few of us are going to want to go there next.
Oh, yeah. This place is magic. So I took the red eye from Mexico straight to the Jubilee. So I was a little tired, but very restored. So I went to this amazing place called Rancho La Puerta, which is in Tecate, Mexico. So it's just over the border from San Diego. And you go for a full week, Saturday to Saturday. So I actually left a little bit early. I left on Friday night. And it's a health and wellness retreat with a full digital detox. So each person has their own casita that's very beautiful, very understated, but still very luxurious, with a wood-burning fire and all this beautiful woodwork from throughout Mexico. And the first thing when you walk into your room, there's a little bag, and it's a sleeping bag for your phone. And so you get to check your phone, let it take a little break. And then all throughout the week, it's this beautiful, beautiful space with this gorgeous organic garden. So all of the food it's mostly vegan, all from on property, beautiful vegetables and fruits from throughout Mexico. And then you start each morning at 6 a.m. with this really restorative hike along the mountain range with the sun coming up and the mist in the air. And then you do all these really fun activities throughout the week, everything from cardio yoga to cardio drumming to some of my favorites were the water aerobics classes like the old ladies do, but it's really fun and hard work. So yeah, it was really great.
So did you really go on a digital detox?
Because I really did.
You own a bar, you own a PR firm.
Yep, I truly, truly did. I told both of my teams, I didn't even give them a choice. I just said that I was doing it and that they, you know, I put an out of office up that said I am out of the country and not checking email. And then the only thing that I did was each day I checked my phone for text messages once a day, but I didn't proactively text anyone unless they had texted me, and then I responded.
And you left your husband behind.
I did. I think he had a nice time solo, but it was a really important time just to relax and reflect. And I think we have such hectic lives, and especially, you know, running two businesses is even crazier than running one. And sometimes we work ourselves to the bone, and it's really important to take the time to work on ourselves and to take a break and eat healthy, delicious food and connect with a lot of amazing people as well.
Well, it sounds amazing. So I'm happy you had the opportunity to do that and get some downtime. So the reason we asked you to be here today is because in addition to owning Magnum PR, you own The Riddler, which is an incredible champagne bar in San Francisco that you opened, like, how long ago
now? In January of last year, so probably 14, 15 months ago.
And it's a wonderful place, but what makes it truly unique is Jen came up with this incredible financing structure for it that I would absolutely love for her to talk through and walk us through, because so many of the conversations today are about money and power and investing and who gets the money and who doesn't. And Jen has some very strong opinions on the subject. So Jen, I'm just going to turn it over to you, and I want you to tell us, how did you put the money together to open the Riddler?
Sure. And I do have a lot of opinions on this. So I started the Riddler. We opened, as I said, 14 months ago. And when I was originally looking for financing for the space, I knew I needed about $650,000. So it was a relatively small raise for a restaurant. But I knew that my husband's also a restaurateur. He owns the restaurant Suvla in San Francisco. And we knew that we wanted to have a completely separate investor community. And so I started pulling together a list of all of the people who I thought might be interesting. And I realized that they were, if not all, mostly women. And so I explicitly opened the investment opportunity up only to women. And because of that, we have 33 investors, all of whom are women, all of whom are really amazing powerhouses who have become a fundamental part of our community and who are incredibly supportive of what we do. And as we look to additional locations, you know, I'd love to do one in New York, one in DC, a few internationally, we will always have this setup where we have 33 investors who are women.
So how did you reach out to them? Are they all friends?
No, some were people who reached out to me when they heard about this setup. Most of them were either friends or mentors. The first person I talked to is the woman who's our lead investor. She put in $250,000, and she was the first person who I secured financing from. And once we had that, obviously that was really helpful for other people to jump on board. And she was somebody who we knew who had a real love of champagne. We knew her as a guest of a lot of really great fine dining restaurants in San Francisco and a real enthusiast of high-end champagne. And so she and I had been talking about this concept for about a year. And then once I found a location and we were moving forward, I put together a business plan and ran it by her first. And, you know, she's a woman of substantial means. And this was something that was really important to her. And it was pretty easy to get her on board, which that was a lucky thing for me. The more of the hustle came from the other 32 women. And I was hustling until the day that we opened our doors for those last, you know, an extra $10,000 here, $5,000 there. Wherein at the end of the project, those smaller $1,000 increments are incredibly impactful for getting the doors open.
So how did you reach out to these women? Did you just cold email them? How does that work?
I would say I initially started with a network of people who I knew well, some of whom I knew had money and many of whom I had no idea had money, and would meet up with friends for coffee or drinks, more often drinks, let's be honest, and would just be talking about what each of us were working on. And I would say, oh, yeah, and I'm opening a champagne bar in Hayes Valley in San Francisco, and here's some information about it. And would tell them all about it, what I was excited about. And they'd be like, oh, my God, that's so amazing. That's so cool. And then at the end, after I had gotten them interested, would say, oh, and by the way, the opportunity is only available to women. And our investment starts at $10,000. And then if they showed some interest, like literally what would happen would be, I would say, oh, and I'm only making the investment available to women. And there would be a light bulb that would go off in their mind of, oh my gosh, this is something that's available to me and it's only being open to women. And this is a club that I want to be a part of. And it became this really powerful thing. The thing that I thought was so fascinating about it was that there were people who definitely had money, and up until me saying that I was only making it available to women, hadn't even thought of the idea that they might be a candidate to finance a bar. And that was a really empowering thing, I think, for a lot of people who had never considered it before. And of all of our investors, only one of them had ever invested in another restaurant.
Wow. Now, it's really hard to ask people for money. People have such oh, you're shaking your head. You don't think it is.
I think if the approach that you're taking is, hi, can I set up a meeting with you to ask you for money? I think that that is hard to do.
Okay.
I think socializing with people of means and telling them about a really exciting idea and floating the possibility out there that this is an opportunity that they could benefit from if they are interested, I don't think that's that hard.
So you just said socializing with people of means. I know sure. There are going to be a lot of women out there listening who are like, that is hard. Like, my friends are broke.
Yeah, but I mean, I think
how do you socialize with people of means?
Okay, so I think the first step is to sit down with a pad of paper or an Excel document and write down every single person you can think of who may have $5,000 in their savings account. There are a lot of people who have $5,000, $10,000, $20,000, and on up in their savings account. And I was surprised by a lot of people who came in for a substantial amount of money. And there definitely were women who I thought had a ton of money and for whom an investment like this would be no big deal, and they didn't end up coming through. But when it comes to socializing with women of means in particular, I would say I do a lot of networking in my life in just a purely social basis and have for the last 15 years with as many amazing women as I possibly can. I socialize with men as well, but I've always had the tendency to build my social network around amazing women who hustle and who do cool stuff. And I try to maintain those relationships for as long as I possibly can. But most of them I wouldn't say are friends. They're more essentially like tangential mentors, people who own their own businesses, who are executives at really cool companies, and who are people who I can learn from. I'm always looking for people who know more about things than I do in whatever their area of interest is. And, you know, but in truth, it took me a year to raise all of the money. And they were, in many cases, in small increments. And there were many people who I talked to who didn't end up investing, but I talked about the project to every single person I interacted with. And I also like spent a lot of additional time taking people out to coffee and drinks than I normally do.
So how much follow-up was required when someone's like, "Ooh, cool, I'm interested. What do you do next?"
Well, so my first piece of advice is to write a really good business plan. First and foremost, you have to have a good understanding of what the business model is. And what that means is, what do the financials look like? How do you make something that is profitable and really compelling? And what do the projections look like? How many days a week are you going to be open? What hours of the day? How many covers do you expect? What do you think the average cover count's going to be? What's the check average? And then what does your staffing look like? What does your food cost look like? What does your beverage cost look like? Your occupancy, all of these sorts of things. So having a really good handle on the numbers is very important.
How did you learn how to write a business plan?
I did a lot of searching online, and I also found a really great financial model that circulates amongst restaurateurs. I would be happy to share it with anybody who wants it. I can send you.
What do you mean
you
found it? How did you find it?
There are definitely communities of people who share assets with one another, tools. I found it from somebody who found it from somebody else, and it's basically just an Excel model that allows you to create, you know, there are inputs for, you know, how many days a week are you open? Just the sorts of things that I mentioned. And it has, you know, coding in the background that allows you to see, okay, well, if I do 100 covers a day, my profitability looks like 2%. If I do 150 a day, it looks like 4%, whatever, those sorts of things. So yeah, so I found it through like a network of people who have access to these things.
Now, do you have a lot of financial acumen? Did you study it in school? What was your major?
I didn't study it in school, but I did. I was big into science fair and math in high school. And I love math. I think it's a lot of fun. But I've never taken a finance class in my life. But it's something that is not super challenging to me. And I find it to be very interesting. More than anything, I find it to be a helpful set of tools to allow me to make decisions about the business. So we now have a business manager whose job it is to create complex financial models about every single thing that we do on a day-to-day basis. And so I'm not generating the models, but I do get the P&Ls on a monthly basis and then micro P&Ls throughout each week.
Micro P&L. What's a micro P&L?
I just made that up. But but like P&Ls that are more of like a real-time P&L. So for example, I look at the numbers every single day in terms of how many covers we did this Tuesday versus last Tuesday. Or if we had, you know, some big wine whales in who spent tons of money on wine, or if we had like a giant group of girls who drank a bunch of sparkling rosé for $12 pop and how that affects our financials. So I do keep tabs of the numbers very closely. I do that also with the Magnum business, where our biggest expenses within the PR business are rent, but much more so headcount. And so we have this very careful balance between headcount and the number of clients that we need to have in a month to be able to sustain that and or to be profitable. So if you don't pay attention to those numbers, then you're just flying blindly. And so having a plan is very helpful for me. So, but in terms of putting together a business plan at the very beginning, the first thing I did was I came up with a concept. So I knew I wanted it to be called The Riddler. I knew that I wanted it to be a corner location I knew.
Just tell everybody the Riddler, because that means something relating to champagne.
So riddling is a part of the champagne making process. It was invented by the woman who is known as the Widow Clicquot, who inherited Veuve Clicquot when she was in her 20s in the 1800s. And at the time, champagne was a cloudy beverage, and she wanted to make it a crystal clear beverage. She was an excellent marketer, and she thought it would sell better if it was clear. And so she took a door off of its frame, and cut some holes in it and turned the bottles upside down into those holes, and then turned them every day so that the sediment would go into the neck, and then essentially chopped off the neck so that the sediment would be released, and then voila, sparkling champagne as we know it now. And so champagne houses still riddle, and many of them still hand riddle every day. And so we're called the Riddler.
Oh, yeah. There you go. Okay. So you teach yourself how to put together this business plan. How do you decide when you're approaching these women how much ownership in the company do you give them?
Great question. So the first thing is to figure out how much money you need to raise. So let's say in my case, we raised $650. I wanted to retain majority ownership. I wanted to retain much more than majority ownership. So I've retained 70% ownership. And so I gave away 30%. So then you do some back of the napkin math. And it is each of our units was $20,000. So if you purchased $20,000, if you put $20,000 in, you get one unit of ownership. And we set our owners up on a preferred return rate, which is a very modern concept within restaurant investment or any other kind of investment, in which investors are paid back first before I am paid back. So they own 30 to 33% of the business, and they get back 125% of their investment until they're 90% paid back. So
Say that one more time.
Oh, I actually said it in the reverse. They get 90% of the profits until they're 125% paid back. So I get 10% of the profits for as long as I have to pay them back. So let's say I have $100,000 worth of profit. Even though I own 70% and should be able to get $70,000 in a traditional setup, I only get $10,000. I give them the $90,000 distributed evenly amongst how much they own, and I do that until they're paid back completely. And basically, it incentivizes me to run as lean and profitably as possible, to pay them back as quickly as possible, so that then it switches and I get 70% of the profits.
And how did you come up with that, the preferred return rate?
I worked with our lawyer, who is a woman in San Francisco. Her name is Roberta Economidis. She's a wonderful Greek lady, and she does a lot of restaurant investments specifically. But if you were to work with any restaurant lawyer or anyone setting up any sort of a business entity, they would understand what a preferred return rate is. And I think if you ever have an interest in opening more than one location, of whether it's a single concept or multiple concepts, it's really smart to do preferred return, because it allows you to start paying people back as quickly as possible, and then you get greater investor confidence for future projects. So I'm really grateful that we ran really lean and we were profitable from the first day, and we've been able to start paying people back at the first year. And so I've had a lot of investors who have gotten their first checks and have reached back out and said, if you're doing additional locations, we'd love to participate in future rounds.
Oh, that's great.
And I think it feels awesome, and it feels great to pay people back. And I would like to pay them back as quickly as I can. But it still is going to take a couple years to do that.
Any bumps along the way?
Of course. So many. We're lucky that we're a really small space. So we are only 500 square feet. We can pack a lot of people in there because we have a lot of outdoor seating. But I would say financially, things have gone really well. The challenges have come with some things related to team, where I have the tendency to give a lot of trust to team members. And in some cases, I haven't made the perfect hire, and I've had to have some hard conversations with people to transition them onto other roles at other places. But I think that those decisions that I've made have been the strongest thing for the company. And so I've really refocused in on strengthening the team as much as possible, giving them as much support as they possibly can have, but also giving them trust, like, and enough trust that I can walk away from the business for a week and let them manage it for a week without me picking up my email.
So any bumps with the investors or things you would do differently the next time around?
Bumps with the investors. I think I can continue to communicate with them even more and to activate them even more. So, you know, I feel like I'm regularly in touch with them, but, and I think initially I was like, oh, I don't want to bother them with too many emails or too many updates, but actually they've all given me a lot of money and they want a lot of updates. So I've learned that. And the other thing is that I would love to use them more, or in a more formalized way, to advocate for the business. So to book private events, to tell all their champagne-loving friends that they should come to events and parties. And that's something that we're thinking about sort of formalizing in the year to come, as well as at future locations, because these are the people who are super, super invested in the success of the business. And they're really making a lifestyle investment when they invest in the Riddler, as opposed to many other kinds of investments that they could make. They really want to feel like they're part of a club and a team. And so we're doing really fun things with getting them swag. And we have this really cool club called the 100 Club, which anybody can participate in. And we have essentially a scorecard. And when you come in and order a bottle of champagne at the Riddler, we mark down which champagnes you drink. And then if you reach 100 bottles, which is quite a feat, you get a bomber jacket with your name embroidered in gold and a big champagne bottle on the back. Kind of very Grease Lightning bomber jacket. And nobody has gotten there yet. We've got somebody
who's
had...
That was my next question.
We have somebody who has had well over 50 bottles, which is pretty impressive in a year. And we've got a few other who are on their ways.
Have you had to manage investor expectations in terms of how quickly they're getting their money back, but also what their perks are, like people
yes.
who think they can just come to the bar
yeah.
and drink for free?
Absolutely. So we're pretty generous with our investors in terms of the perks that they get. They always get a reservation, which is actually one of the biggest perks because it's pretty hard to get a table.
I can attest to that. Not an investor, but wish I had been.
Carrie, you always have a table. So they always get a table, which is great. They get priority access to some events, and then they do always get a discount, and we always send them extra goodies, caviar and tater tot waffles and things like that. And then they do have the ability as well to purchase champagne at cost from us, which is a really big perk. And we are about to roll out an official champagne concierge program where our beverage director will help you select wines for dinner parties or events that you're doing at your house. And so they're going to have an opportunity to sort of beta test that. They also get fun gifts, and we sent them a really beautiful champagne book for Christmas with this really cool wrapping paper that we had custom made for us. But we've been lucky. We don't have any investors who sort of abuse their power. And if anything, we're excited to see people who come in every week or every other week, and we're happy to give them some freebies and benefits because they have been our earliest supporters.
Now, when you hear people talk about how difficult it is to raise money, how difficult it is for women to raise money, you agree that it has been difficult, but you don't think it should be difficult. You think there are things that women could be doing to make it easier on themselves.
I think
that there are a lot
of narratives that women repeat that they tell themselves and they also talk about publicly that I think harm their ability to succeed. First and foremost, I think a lot of women say, oh, I'm not good at the financials. I don't understand that piece, and that's really confusing for me. Okay, well, if that's the case, you need to learn that because you should not own a business if you don't understand those things or if you're afraid of them. You should instead find like a business partner who's really good at that piece or hire a business manager. But you have to have a full understanding of how to talk about a P&L and how to talk about rate of return and all those things. Otherwise, no one will give you money, or only foolish people will. So that's first and foremost. The other thing is that I think if we keep saying, oh, it's really hard for women to raise money, and if you go into every fundraising conversation with that in mind, then of course it's going to be hard for you. Or I often hear, oh, women don't speak positively about their own businesses, or they don't speak with grand plans, or they don't speak like a visionary. Well, you just have to speak like a visionary. You have to be a visionary. You have to be willing to say, oh, we have this location. I know it's going to be profitable in the first year. I know I want to do additional locations in New York, DC, London, Tokyo, and Champaign. And then once you tell people that, then they're like, oh, this person is a visionary. That doesn't mean you absolutely have to be willing to make those kinds of risky comments, and you have to believe in yourself. But I personally haven't found it hard to fundraise. I realize that that's not the case for everyone, but I think that a lot of it comes down to having an understanding of the financials and then also being really, really willing to take a risk on yourself, and also to, you have to bring people along. They have to feel as confident about you as you do. And if you don't feel confident in your own abilities, then no one is going to write you a check for $10,000, $5,000, $100,000. Like, if you don't believe in your own idea or your ability to succeed at it, then no one else will.
That's good advice.
So, you know, perk up, ladies. You can do it.
So in terms of financial literacy, you're like, go teach yourself.
Yeah, I mean, there are some really good resources online. One of the best resources is an ebook that was put out by the team at OpenTable called How to Open a Restaurant, and you can download it. And that has a lot of the basics of how to open and run a restaurant. I definitely recommend going to as many conferences as possible. So in San Francisco, we have the Golden Gate Restaurant Association, and they host all sorts of B2B workshops. But you can also like take classes through General Assembly on, you know, how to finance a business. And then also, I was so fortunate to go to the Restaurant High event that you all hosted from Cherry Bomb. That was, I would say, next level of financing conversations with regards to growing your restaurant business at scale. Those were some, that day was such a powerful day for me because it allowed me to shift my thinking from individual store level economics to larger institutional financing models, and to think much beyond just the four walls of my individual space in San Francisco. So there are loads of great resources online. There's tons of podcasts. There's a lot of information out there.
Because, you know, I own a coffee shop now, yeah, and I'm trying to improve my financial literacy, which I'm one of those people you talked about who, ladies, if you don't know it, learn it. So yeah, I'm trying to learn it now. And trying to find some podcasts and just educate myself any way possible. And good news is I found a great bookkeeper and
that's
a great accountant.
Essential.
Yes.
That's essential. And I will say, like, in the beginning, I was sloppier than I should have been with my financials in terms of bookkeeping specifically. I thought that I could do more of it. I thought it wasn't going to take that much time. Definitely get a bookkeeper from day one. Make sure you have a really good tax accountant, an accountant who's specifically focused on setting you up for paying as little tax as you possibly can. Make sure you have a really good lawyer.
The non-sexy stuff.
Yeah.
I think.
Well, and also, like, if that's not what you want to spend your time doing, then just hire someone to do
right.
it and make sure you have enough money in the bank to pay them.
I know PR is key and you are a PR person, but before you even hire that PR person, find the right bookkeeper, accountant, and lawyer.
Before.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think people realize necessarily how important that is until you learn the hard way.
Yes.
Some other resources that you look to.
I really feel that most restaurant associations on the local level are incredibly helpful. So I'll speak specifically to the GGRA in San Francisco, which has a resource center that gives you all of the information about permitting, about the appropriate usage for a specific piece of real estate advice, information about like downloadable handbooks that make you legally compliant, and that sort of set you up for success for all of those nitty-gritty things, HR details, all of these things that are super, that are not the reason why at least I got into the restaurant business, but are really foundational to the success of a restaurant business. I would say also don't be afraid to hire consultants. So if the writing of the business plan piece feels really overwhelming and daunting, do some research online and see who writes business plans. And people can write them for you. I would recommend being very involved in the creation of them, and I think that they're really fun to write. My business plan had a lot of financials, but also was very, very visual. So the first place that I started was actually just creating a bunch of Pinterest boards about what I wanted the look and feel of the space to look like, what I wanted menu to look like, what I wanted graphics to look like. And I basically did like mood boards and then translated that to a story about what the Riddler was going to be, how you were going to feel, and then also backed it up with really strong financials. But if that feels out of your area of comfort, do some research into who writes business plans. But I would recommend finding people who are very design-driven and who do really cool business plans, or decks, basically. Like, work with a great graphic designer. Make it look sexy and cool.
Right, because there's a lot of romance and storytelling involved in what we do.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so women need to get over their fear of numbers. They need to educate themselves. They need to not be afraid to ask for money. But how about on the flip side? Are women investing enough?
You've got the people
asking for money, but are the women out there who have money doing enough to invest in women-owned and fueled and run businesses?
I think that's a great question. I think that the answer to that is an unequivocal no. There are not enough women who are investing, whether it's in restaurant businesses or private investments overall. I think that that is tied specifically to the fact that, like, we've got these new generations of people who, where it's like definitely non-negotiable that in a two-parent household or a couple, the woman is definitely working. This is a new thing. And, you know, even in the ways that we're getting more progressive about things like prenups, let's say, like, you know, women are financially independent in a whole new way. And I think historically we haven't taken tons of risk because we haven't had the opportunity to. We haven't had our own money that we've made that's our own. And so now that we do, we have a lot of opportunities to take some risk with the assets that we have. And it's one of those risk-reward things. Like, I always think the rich get richer. And I think if you've got a little bit of money, don't be foolish about it, but definitely look around for opportunities to grow that money 3, 5, 6, 10x, as opposed to just having it sitting in, you know, your Roth IRA, although it's important to have a Roth IRA as well.
Are you daydreaming about culinary school again? Make this the year your dreams become reality with Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school. Study classic French culinary techniques in cuisine and patisserie as part of their exclusive 9-month Le Grand Diplôme, and graduate into a world of opportunity. You also can extend your course of studies to include culinary management and dedicated internships. Le Cordon Bleu has locations in more than 20 countries around the world and located within some of the best food cities out there: London, Ottawa, Madrid, Bangkok, Tokyo, and of course, the spiritual home of cuisine and Le Cordon Bleu, Paris. Turning your daydreams into reality is closer than ever. Visit cordonbleu.edu for more and let your culinary adventure begin. It's time for our Bob's Red Mill Minute. We have a new baked good at my coffee shop, Smith Canteen, in Carroll Gardens, Brooklyn, that our baker, Gabby Vigoureux, debuted last week. You might have heard Gabby a few weeks ago on this very show. Anyway, Gabby came up with a toasted coconut fresh blueberry scone, and she can't make enough of them. She wanted to update her basic scone recipe with something seasonal, so that's where the blueberries come in, and the toasted coconut felt light and summery. Gabby pulses Bob's Red Mill regular rolled oats to make her flour mixture, and she toasts Bob's Red Mill shredded coconut and adds in plump blueberries. Gabby said she loves the oat flour and the toasted coconut because it makes the scones extra craggy. She wasn't sure if craggy sounded like a good enough description, but you get the idea. You get all those great little crunchy hills and valleys in the scone. Anyway, come by the canteen if you'd like to try one. They're really delicious. They do usually sell out before lunchtime, just a warning. Anyway, Bob's Red Mill is always a blast to bake with. Don't forget that with Bob's Red Mill, you're not just getting quality, you're getting flavor-packed ingredients that taste amazing. Visit bobsredmill.com today.
Moxie Rosenbloom. My dad, Harry Rosenbloom, hosts Feast Your Ears on Heritage Radio Network. Right now, HRN is having a summer membership drive. Becoming a member is so easy, and you'll help support shows like my dad's. You can sign up for a one-time donation or become a monthly sustaining member by visiting heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Let's keep food radio on the airwaves this summer.
So what's next?
Oh, good question. So I would say the thing that I think the most about right now is about balancing my life between Magnum PR and the Riddler. And I feel incredibly lucky to have two teams of people who really run each of those businesses, and I help to guide both of the ships. And I'm looking for additional ways to make my life a little bit more reasonable.
I struggle with that.
Right? Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. Of course. So I'm looking forward to growth both on the Magnum side and on the Riddler side. But specifically with the Riddler, I'm really excited because I'm taking a trip to Champaign in 2 weeks with my beverage director and my lead investor, and then with one of our importing and distribution partners from Martine's, which is an amazing champagne company that was started by a woman named Martine, who's the subject of A Year in Champagne and A Year in Burgundy. And so a dear friend of ours, Greg Castells, who used to be the beverage director of the French Laundry, he bought Martine's from Martine. And so I'm partnering up with him on a private label wine project that will be a line of champagnes and a line of sparkling rosé. So the rosé will be a great entry-level price point sparkling wine.
And so wait, you're going to have your own? Wow.
Yeah. I'm That's really, fun. Really excited
I
about it.
I thought you were saying you're partnering up with him to do trips to Champagne.
No, trips for me.
Would be fun too.
No, we're going to actually roll out a line of both champagnes and sparkling
Good
wine,
for you.
Which I'm really, really excited about. So we're hoping that it will hit shelves around October so that we can capitalize on this year's holiday season and gift giving. But I feel like a lot of the champagne brands like Veuve Clicquot and Moët Chandon, all of these brands, they don't have a lot of competition. And I think that we can give them
I'm a Tattinger girl.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's so delicious.
Do you have
right?
Tattinger?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, good.
Absolutely.
Tell us, for people who haven't been to the Riddler, which I adore, tell people what they can expect when they go there.
Yeah,
and please talk about the tater tot waffles.
Oh, I will definitely talk about those. So it's a small space. It was a cafe for 27 years, and it has all of this beautiful existing woodwork and this gorgeous back bar. And we kind of just lightly cleaned it up and then did some really fun things, like we gold-leafed the ceiling and put in a beautiful, beautiful, large-scale black-and-white photograph of a really sexy lady and, you know, things like that. And we have over 100 champagnes by the bottle, everything from half bottles all the way up to 9 liters. So that's like a case of wine in one bottle.
Wait, how big is a 9 liter?
A 9 liter is so heavy that you almost need two people to carry it.
Do they have one of the names for it?
They do. I can't remember what a 9 liter is.
Like the Balthazars and all those.
It's one of the really big ones.
Okay.
We sell a lot of Magnums. I'm a huge Magnum advocate. I'd like to get the world drinking Magnums more often. If you think you're going to drink a second bottle, you should just open a Magnum instead. And we, like I said, we have over 100 champagnes by the bottle. We have a beautiful collection of found vintage champagne buckets. So
here
each
we go.
Bottle
I just looked
comes,
up the names.
Oh, what's the 9 liter?
A Methuselah.
Oh, yeah.
Is the same size as an Imperial, 6 liters, but the name is usually used for sparkling wines in a burgundy shaped bottle.
There you go.
Okay.
Fun fact of the day.
Methuselah. All right. Interesting. Anyway, Continue.
So we have a very small kitchen. So we do, you know, beautiful little bites, cheese, charcuterie, our caviar we serve with potato chips and creme fraiche. And then because we do not have a full kitchen with a hood, we had to get creative with our cooking equipment. So our only cooking equipment are waffle irons. And a classic pairing with champagne are French fries. So instead of French fries, we take tater tots and we put them into a waffle iron and we waffle them.
Wait, you take the, they're already tater tot shaped.
They're like
you put them
tater,
in there?
They're like Ore-Ida frozen tater tots.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
They're
like I thought true. You had like sort of a mixture.
Nope. They are
got it.
A purchased
wow.
frozen tater tot.
Way to repurpose the
right?
tot.
And once you waffle them, they get even more nooks and crannies. And so it turns into almost like a very large potato pancake. And then I'm a big fan of the high-low. So we take the tater tots, that's the low, and then we put really luxurious toppings like caviar and creme fraiche and smoked salmon, or occasionally we'll do like a soft-boiled egg and shaved black truffle. And they're basically like a really, really delicious latke or potato pancake.
Are you all understanding that Jen is the girl you want to roll with? I hope that's coming through the airwaves
yeah.
to all
yeah,
of you.
We can definitely all roll. Yeah. So we do that.
She's going to
really
find
fun.
You money. She's
that's
going
right.
to feed you. She's going to pour you a lot of sparkling wine.
Yeah. I don't know why everyone doesn't own a champagne bar, by the way. It seems like it's such a no-brainer. I mean, it's a lot of fun to
only
do.
You would say that. And wait, and then you have popcorn.
Yes, we have a free popcorn machine, so you can serve yourself, and it's free popcorn all day long, and then we've got all these salts and seasonings. We have many that are named after ladies. So Scarlett Johansson, if you are listening, we have a popcorn topping called the ScarJo, which is white truffle, Parmesan, and sage, and it is ScarJo's favorite topping from her popcorn bar in Paris. And it's very delicious.
And don't you have a Heidi Swanson?
We have a Heidi Swanson, which of course has nutritional yeast and turmeric and saffron. And I think some white sesame seeds in there, which is super delicious. I stole it from her blog. And she lives in the neighborhood, so we get to see her often, which is really nice. And then we've got essentially a spin on elote. It's like a Mexican corn topping. We have an everything bagel salt, all of those fun things.
So much fun.
Yeah. And a really fun thing also, ScarJo, again, if you're listening, we have a series of reserved signs. So when you make a reservation, you get a reserved sign that says reserved for Beyonce, reserved for Scarlett Johansson, reserved for Ruth Reichel, reserved for...
Isn't Ruth one of your investors?
She is.
Is that public information?
That is public information. Okay. She is, which I feel incredibly fortunate about. And she's such a supporter, and we love her very dearly. I had a chance to work with Ruth when I was at the Gilt Group many years ago, and she's just always been such a positive force in my life. So I feel lucky to officially get to have her on board.
Well, one of the things I would love to do next is have another finance seminar, because the one that we did was definitely advanced.
Oh, yeah.
And
that
I
one
feel
was
like we
really
need
advanced.
One that's sort of like a notch down mm-hmm. where we just have some success stories.
Yep.
You know, we have people like you and Martha Hoover and Aaron from Ovenly is so smart and so willing to share resources and just have people talk about how they did it.
Yep.
You know, the bumps along the way, the highs, the lows, all of it. Even you probably laughed when you heard Amshika speak at Jubilee on Saturday. She financed the whole damn thing on her credit cards. She
I
has
know.
A Thai restaurant in yeah. Littleton, New Hampshire, and couldn't get money. The banks just laughed at her when she said she wanted to open a Thai restaurant. And she was profitable in a year,
yep.
but she had to put everything on her mother-in-law's credit card.
Oh, it happens all the time. It really does.
And you're saying it shouldn't.
Oh, I mean, I think that that's a great way to do it. If you've got enough credit, it's hard to do that if you're looking at a project that's $1 million or more, unless you've got really excellent credit. And in that case, you probably have a really good grasp of finances if you've got $1 million of line of credit. But it's just, it's different for each person. But the thing that she was so smart about, she had a business plan. She was really focused on it. She was super tenacious. She met with a ton of people who said no to her. And she said, well, screw it. I'm just going to do it myself. It's kind of the idea of, have you read this book, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck?
Not yet, but I want to.
It's great. Mm-hmm. It's great. And his point is he kind of has two points. One is you only have so many fucks to give, so only give fucks about things that really matter. Like, don't get mad at the Starbucks line. Like, that's a dumb way to use your fucks. And then the other one is that you have to, if you really want something, you have to not give a fuck that it's hard to do. And you have to be willing to just keep doing it. Like, if you want to be a rock star and you aren't comfortable playing to an empty room, if that really upsets you or feels boring or, you know, you don't want to do it anymore, well, then you're never going to become a rock star. Same thing when it comes to owning a restaurant. You have to be willing to just get out there, face a lot of rejection, and just keep at it. I mean, that's like marathoners. They're like, okay, just another mile. Here we go. And you have to be willing to just put in the work.
Well, I think that's a great place to end. Well, Jen, thank you so much. If any of you are out in San Francisco, go to the Riddler and go see what this is all about. And thank you for sharing your story of how you got the place open. And I hope it's just the first of many conversations we have about finance and helping women make their dreams reality.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Carrie. And you all can do it. I believe in you.
You're the bomb, Jen.
Bye. You too.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to Jen Pelka for sharing her wisdom and for being so honest about her fundraising process. I learned a lot, and I hope you did too. If you happen to be in San Francisco, make sure to visit the Riddler and support Jen. It's a wonderful place, and those tater tot waffles are really as good as they sound. Thank you to our sponsors, Bob's Red Mill, the best friend of every baker we know, and Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and Heritage Radio Network. You can subscribe to our show wherever you listen to podcasts, and you can subscribe to Cherry Bomb Magazine at cherrybomb.com. Our theme song is by the band Tra La La, and our engineer today is the one and only DJ Dave Tattershore. Don't forget, our new issue and tickets to our live radio event in Austin are on sale right now via cherrybomb.com. And also the Heritage Radio Network Summer Fun Drive is taking place now through July 31st. Help us to raise $25,000 and become an HRN member. There are a lot of great prizes. So check out heritageradionetwork.org for more. Okay, thank you. And thanks for listening, all of you. You're the bomb.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Radio Cherry Bomb is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.